everybody. I'm Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 65 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Call of the Road, River, and Rail, Cassavant Talks Transportation. About my conversation with Ken Cassavant, agricultural economist at Washington State University. When it comes to my education in agriculture, I know a little about a lot of different things. As an outsider who came into agriculture through journalism, I certainly understand more than my Spokane neighbors about the wheat farming that surrounds the city. But that knowledge is often a mile wide and only an inch deep. This is particularly the case when it comes to transportation economics. Back in my reporting days, I would read a report on some aspect of agriculture's transportation infrastructure, interview the author, and write a story. See what I mean about an inch deep? I partly blame my boss, Glenn Squires, for my failure to have kept up with the discipline. You see, Glenn came to the attention of the commission years ago through Cassavant, the subject of this episode. When former Washington Grain Commission CEO Tom Mick needed someone to conduct a transportation study for the wheat industry, Cassavant recommended an up-and-coming graduate student of his. That graduate student was, you guessed it, Glenn. Tom and Glenn hit it off, and the rest, as they say, is history, including my not paying as close attention to transportation economics as I might have otherwise. Shame on you, Glenn. You'll hear ahead that I met Cassavant about 25 years ago when I was a reporter during a rail abandonment hearing on the line that, as I recall, ran from Fairfield to Teco and perhaps on to Moscow. It's been a long time and the facts are hazy. Although Class 1 railroads had been abandoning these feeder lines for a long time, this was the first time it happened in eastern Washington's backyard. On the surface, the economics were simple. The line simply wasn't making money. But this wasn't a case of the railroad simply ceasing to operate. This was about actually tearing up the rail. Cassavant argued such lines were like money in the bank. But in the case of the Teco line, the Interstate Commerce Commission permitted the abandonment. Someone told me years later that the rails were sent to Japan and pounded into the sea to build more land, but I could never confirm that. I wish I'd taken more of an interest in transportation over the years because my interview with Cassavant really brought back what I had been missing. Cassavant! He's a fun interview, relaxed and open. He's also kind. Listen as he gently corrects me on my use of the wrong word to describe dam breaching and how he turns my slip into a teachable moment. I've got to imagine it's that kind of thing which has been central to the longevity of his 50-year teaching career at WSU. I could list all the awards Cassavant has received, his achievements, and the boards and organizations on which he serves, but then there wouldn't be any time for the interview. I began by asking Cassavant to describe the Northwest transportation infrastructure.
Okay, let me break that down. First of all, we in the Northwest are blessed by the fact that we have three alternatives, what we economists call a complete transportation system. Many other areas are totally dependent on rail or dependent on water transportation solely. Here we have all three. We've got a water system that is lower cost. We have to the shipper. It is cleaner in as far as energy utilization. It causes less road damage to the roads. It has all the positives. The driver is it's lower cost to the shipper. Rail can move a lot of product in a hurry in large quantities, particularly with the new shuttle systems that have been developed here in the Northwest. They've actually been developed all over the nation, but we've taken advantage of them. We have now four shuttles, which with the economies associated with that.
How does our transportation system impact our competitiveness in the world market?
Well, it's as it turns out, it's critical to it. We in the Northwest have, believe it or not, a cost of production that is higher than some of the other producing areas. For example, like Brazil, land is so cheap, and labor is very available. So our cost of production, we have a little bit of a competitive disadvantage. But what we've had historically is a great transportation advantage. The economies and the efficiencies that we have here of our transport system makes the delivered cost very competitive against other countries.
You have a contract to analyze the Snake River drawdown as part of a judicial order handed down by an Oregon judge who wants an environmental impact statement focused on salmon restoration. Haven't we been here before?
Over the last 20, 30 years, there's been a lot of interest in looking at what breaching or drawdowns or whatever you want to call it, what the impacts of that would do. There are other areas that the courts and biologists are working at trying to restore the salmon, habitat, harvest changes, and so on. But a continued one that comes back is river operations, and that deals with the potential of lowering the dams, lowering the water around the dams.
Now, we have this incredible infrastructure of these dams along the Snake River. The idea of tearing these out, not knowing what we're going to need in the future, just strikes me as backward. And I'm curious what your perspective is on tearing the dams out.
Well, I don't think anybody's talking about tearing out the dams. It may be just euphemism, but they talk about dam breaching, meaning to go around it. Frankly, if you go to tear out a major dam, the environmental impacts of tearing that out would probably stop you right now. But there's still a lot of thought and possibility of breaching the dams, mainly for the navigation function. Remember, the dams were first put in for electricity, for power generation, and flood control. And then over time, an added reason, and an important one, was navigation in this region. So if we breach the dam and affect navigation, we're probably going to affect those other two as well.
You were just talking about competitiveness and how important competitiveness is for the bottom line of our wheat growers. What would the loss of the Snake River dams mean to farmers in eastern Washington? And are there impacts that aren't obvious?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen, it is going to be increased costs. The rate or that the shipper, the grower has to pay will probably increase. All of our studies indicate that right now the lowest rate available for most of the farmers in the Northwest is by barge, by water transportation. The new shuttles and that transportation configuration lower that difference quite a bit. So some of our studies indicate, there's still a cost increase. It's not the 30, 40 cents that people were worried about earlier, but it could be down in the 10, 15 cent range. Still, if you look at a farmer, 1,000 acres, 100 bushels per, that's still a big hit every year.
You could still load barges out of the Tri-Cities. Is it really that necessary to have the barges go all the way up to Lewiston?
The answer is just what I said before. It's going to be increased costs. Anytime you put any bulk grain in a small vehicle, a vessel, like a truck, it's expensive to get it down to the Tri-Cities. We'd have to build larger transshipment facilities. There's some down there, but I haven't looked specifically, but I expect the capacity wouldn't be enough to handle all the movement that came down here. So it's a feasible alternative. We haven't yet looked at what the cost and the impact of that going in that direction would be.
There are many in the wheat industry who believe that the effort to breach the Snake River dams is the first step down a slippery slope toward removing Columbia River dams. What do you think?
Boy, I've not heard any discussion about that, and I try to stay tuned and both academically and politically visit with the shippers, and I haven't heard even the environmental people talking about taking out the Columbia dams. That would be a major restructuring hit for electrical generation, for not so much irrigation down that far, but flood control and so on. I just haven't heard that. So slippery slope, I think that it can be divided where we look specifically at the Snake River and the operations on that river and separate that from Columbia River, the lower Columbia River dams.
Now, you and I first met at a hearing on the abandonment of a rail line between Fairfield and Teco, and that was 25 years ago, and the rail line was abandoned. For all intents and purposes, it appears that the Class 1 railroads have won the battle. Would you agree, or do you feel the state's efforts have saved the day by purchasing some of the remaining short lines like the PCC?
There's no question that when a line is abandoned, shippers and growers, to the extent they were using it before, the reason it's going to get abandoned is they weren't using it much, to the extent those folks are going to be affected. We've been fortunate. When the Staggers Rail Act first went in, it allowed our railroads to make hard business decisions. Well, they made them, and we suffered as a result. But they abandoned lines. Initially, that was what they did. They just abandoned them, pulled up the rail, and used it somewhere else. Then over time, they began to sell the lines, and short line railroads were created. And short lines are more competitive. They're not faced with all of the rules and regulations. They have a better, more personal interaction with their local shippers, so as a result, their volume would increase. So we lost the lines, including the one we fought about, and then they effectively, now in the Southeast, we're totally dependent on short line railroads. We've been blessed, again, by the fact that the Washington State, like several other states, has stepped in and purchased the lines to keep them operating and had some funding available to rehab the lines. Unfortunately, when they sold the lines, what the railroad sold was a deteriorated, dilapidated pile of track because they didn't want to put any money in if they weren't getting money back. Again, that hard business decision. But now our short lines are in operation, but they're marginal. We just finished a study for the state looking at the benefits of state line ownership versus the costs if they abandon them or eliminate them. And there's no question that when you look at shipper impacts, pavement impacts, energy impacts, that the state made a good decision for the public when they stepped in and saved those lines.
What about the inefficiencies of the short lines? These railroads the locomotives can only travel at about 10 miles an hour. There are derailments every year. Can that kind of inefficiency continue?
As far as the slow speed, I'm reminded of the old joke about what's time to a pig. Speed isn't as important in the kinds of collecting functions we're performing with those short line railroads. We don't want to drop it off the side by having derailments, but generally, at the level we're operating, if we can get it up to 20 miles an hour, 25, everybody will feel fine as far as the service that's being offered. Again, like I said, time isn't as important to a bushel of wheat.
But getting that speed up to 25 miles an hour is going to take millions of dollars, correct?
I would expect so. I think the railroads will do it selectively. The state will do it selectively. And maybe we as economists can help them prioritize some of those investments. It will take a lot of money. But there's a lot of value being received by it, too. If you look at when that grain moves off of the rail and onto our country roads and our county highways that weren't built for heavy traffic like that and the larger trucks, there's a lot of damage that occurs. So when that happens, we end up being better off by put in a lot of money. It's got millions on it. There's a lot of zeros there. But there's zeros that are a good investment.
Country elevator managers now, they keep a lot of balls in the air with regard to their transportation. I see trucks moving grain between facilities. I hear of elevators who sell COTS, certificates of transportation issued by the railroads, and then they ship their grain by barge. Are elevators nowadays as much transportation companies as they are grain companies?
Well, remember, what their function... Oh, the answer is yes. They have to do both right now. The storage function isn't as important as it used to be, but getting the grain to the markets is critical. As far as selling COTS or selling transportation capacity, remember, most of our grain here goes through co-ops. So any savings, if a manager looks and tries to decide, should I use my certificate of transportation to move some grain, or should I, if I can sell it and make more money, bring it back to, in the form of cooperative dividends, back to the producer, I'm going to do it. And I'll ship it by rail, or I'll ship it by truck, or I'm sorry, I'll ship it by truck or barge if that happens.
When I started in agriculture more than 30 years ago, it was thought that shuttle train loaders didn't make sense in eastern Washington because of the short haul to ports. Now we have 4 shuttle train loaders. What changed to make them economically viable?
Well, the critical thing was the rate offered by the railroads. I said earlier, railroads like to hook and haul. They don't like to do a lot of the assembly. What has happened now is, rather than having a lot of stations where they load grain, they have the farmer or the co-op elevator bring it to one shuttle location, and then they can move a lot of grain in a short period of time. So that technological change of shuttle trains, where you hook them together, you run them to the port, you unload them quickly, turn around and run right back and load them again, that efficiency is why shuttles are working.
With 4 shuttle train loaders, however, do we risk losing our focus on the river?
Well, the river is going to be available there, available to the shippers. But again, geographically, the 4 shuttles are taking grain that historically might have been trucked to the river. But the grain that is close to the river right now, 20, 30 miles away, maybe a little more, that's still focused on the river. It's going to be in the marginal areas up in the Ritzville area and west, where it's a longer drive with an expensive truck to get to the river, where we might, the river may not be carrying as much now or in the future as it did earlier.
Well, and doesn't that reduce volumes give the folks who want to breach the dams ammunition?
Well, certainly. Anytime the volume lowers on the river, those that say there's no value associated with the barge, they're missing the fact that the remaining, whatever's there, millions of bushels still moving down, they're still getting that value, and they're still getting that competition against the railroads. You know, we talk about something called water-compelled rates, and maybe this would be a good time to just visit briefly. As late as 2012, we were moving our grain out of eastern Washington at 1964 rail rates. That wasn't because of the benevolence of the Burlington Northern Union Pacific. It was because they had competition from the water. So we call that water-compelled rates. Even if the grain doesn't even go on the water, the grain, and therefore the grower, benefits from having that competition available to him.
But you're not concerned at all that rail could draw enough volume from the river to make barging economically unattractive?
As I think about that question, I guess I would be concerned if it's not being used on the river. There'll be less political support for the maintenance and rehabilitation of the facilities and dams on the river. So if it goes down to some level, and I don't know what that is, there could be a pressure to not pay for the maintenance and not dredge and so on. I guess that is both a political, not really an economic decision, but a political decision.
You were talking just earlier about how the short line railroads are helping in terms of keeping the trucks off of the roads and road damage. How successful have state and county governments been in keeping up with road maintenance?
It's always an issue, but they've learned over time to focus on those roads where the seasonality is a critical issue, where you have times when they're legislated off the roads because of the road conditions. But generally, they've been doing a good job of making decisions about where to invest. They still need more monies, and that's why they'll go to the state and they'll go to their counties and try and get the support to invest in that infrastructure.
Companies are experimenting with autonomous trucks, and they're expected to be on the road in the next 5 years. Does that mean that farmers will be dealing with autonomous trucks, what do we call them, self-driving trucks, yeah, as the new trucks are traded down into agriculture?
It's possible that we will see that. I've been around so long, I don't know if I can look 20 or 30 years in the future. But what I do know is this. Right now, we have, nationally, in the trucking industry, we have a shortage of drivers. But looking at grain movements locally, in most cases, we have local folks moving local product. And they haul, and then they do something else on the weekend. They may be part-time farmers. They may be using their vehicle that they use for harvest. But when it's not used there, they bring it in. So I don't think for grain movements we'll see an impact in that area. Our grain transportation, when it is on truck, they're professional truck drivers, many of them, but they're also someone else, and they're locally oriented. Now, our fruit and vegetable guys, that might be different. That's a longer haul. Those folks are they come in and they pick up a load. They may not return for 2 or 3 weeks. But for grain movements here, I don't expect that to be an issue.
That's good news about the availability of truckers in the Pacific Northwest to move grain, because they are an essential link in the chain that gets our Pacific Northwest wheat crop to market. I hope you enjoyed episode 65, or what I've entitled, The Call of the Road, River, and Rail, Cassavant Talks Transportation, about my conversation with Ken Cassavant, WSU agricultural economist in his 50th year on the job. Once again, I've been unable to distill an hour's worth of fascinating conversation into the 20 or so minutes I'm afforded here, so, no surprise, I'm producing a sequel to this podcast entitled Return of the Road, River, and Rail, Cassavant Talks Transportation. In the next episode, you'll hear the transportation economist discuss why our river system is such a win for the region, why he thinks transportation efficiencies have been an important ingredient in country elevator consolidations, and what have been the best and worst things that have happened to transportation in eastern Washington during his career. All that and more here on episode 66 of Weed All About It!
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home. They don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls, we feed you, we feed you.